Greetings, and welcome to the 11th installment of our podcast series, The Workforce Lens, brought to you by Tarrant County College in North Texas. I am Shannon Bryant, Executive Vice President for Corporate Solutions and Economic Development, and I will be your host, moderating strategic conversations with employers and economic developers on all things related to preparing and growing the workforce today and the future. For this episode of the Workforce Lens podcast, we enter the world of artificial intelligence. Today, my guest is Gary Davis, CEO of Smart Action, a tech company that designs and installs automated call answering systems. Welcome, Gary. Happy to have you here today.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So let's start out. I want to know all about Smart Action and the company, the mission. Tell us about the organization, if you will.
Sure. We, as a company, we started out as a more of a think tank, if you will. People getting together trying to figure out, how do I make a computer think like a person? Somewhere along the way, they had the organization had the nascent versions of what maybe you would experience today with Siri, but at the time weren't sure how to monetize or what to do with it. The founder had, a friend that worked in a call center and said, you know, it'd be great if you could make it that work for customer service instead of push one for, push two for, and a company was born. So over the years, we've leveraged in-house our own technology. You know, our early stage ideas were, you know, this isn't easy. Customer service isn't easy. Automation isn't easy. The AI is not easy. So how do we make it less hard? How do we provide frictionless interactions for our customers.
Mm-hmm. I like that, frictionless.
Yeah. So, and then over time, we've continued as the market has shifted and certain aspects of, for example, speech recognition or text-to-speech have become more commoditized, we've narrowed our focus on what happens in between those things. And that's where that artificial intelligence comes into play. And, you know, our goal is to ensure that, you know, our customers' customers are getting the help they need. The idea behind using a machine to deal with a human interaction and making it as human as possible. Nobody's getting fooled here. We're not some fake human in place, but right. We certainly can provide, you know, a level of service and really save the call center, the human-to-human interaction, for the more complex things that aren't repeatable or scriptable or quick. And, you know, how do we relieve that pressure? So, our goal has been and continues to be to, you know, provide the best experience and, you know, help our customers maintain their brand awareness and their customer relationships while giving the customers the help they need and giving the call centers the relief they're looking for.
So. Great. How large is the company, Gary? How many employees do you have?
We're right around 70 employees. We kind of, it fluctuates here and there depending on, needs and career paths. But so we're 70 employees. We've been around about 12, 13 years now. As an organization.
And you've been with this, you've been the CEO how long?
I've been the CEO for a little over 2 years, and okay. I've been with the company just about three years.
Okay. So great. And tell us a little bit about, so you're talking about serving the customers of the customers. Mm-hmm. What kind of industries do you serve?
So I know it's a cop-out to say we're industry agnostic, but, you know, we work in certain verticals. We work in hospitality, medical, retail, service, if you will. We do roadside assistance. We do where's my order. We do I need to schedule a doctor appointment. I need to change my hotel reservation. I want to upgrade my room. Like, so, you know, we're taking a foundational thing, like, let's say, scheduling. Mm-hmm. But then we are able to then configure that scheduling piece based on the vertical a customer would be in. So at the end of the day, whether you're making an appointment for, you know, you're making an appointment or a reservation for a room to see a doctor for a tea time, whatever it may be, it's all still what day, what time, and what's available, and who do you want to see, or what course do you want to play, or what hotel do you want to stay at. So it's just a set of variables. But that foundational element is similar for all, and we do the configuration. So we then take, call it, you know, 15, 20 of those modules, and based on a vertical, assemble them into, okay, so for insurance, you want things like, you know, claims management and first notice of loss, but, you know, medical, I want to know where my referral is. And the similar concepts, but they each feel different depending on the vertical you're in.
Right. So you're able to establish kind of a foundation,
yes,
for each of the industries.
That's
and
right.
Then customize it according to the client.
That's
very
yes.
Similar to what kind of the corporate solutions department does here at TCC.
Fair enough.
So. Okay, yeah. Great. So can you give us an example of, just so the audience can understand, perhaps a message? How do you humanize a message, if you will, for a call center client?
I think part of it is you use a lot of human adjectives, if you will, things like empathy, care, you come across understanding, or the idea is to create an environment that when the phone is picked up and the machine says, "How can I help you today?" Mm-hmm. And you say, I can't find, where's my order? I'm looking for my order, or I want to pay my bill, or I need a doctor's appointment. And then the next thing it does is it understands what you said and starts to help you do that. Establishing that almost trust is probably the right word, but that trust with the caller that, hey, okay, this thing's going to help me. I'm going to give it a chance. Right. Thank you for calling so-and-so, push 1-4. Immediately, everyone's just like, operator. Very quickly, people want to bail out of that because yeah. It's all on me to figure out which buttons I have to push to get to where I want to go. Whereas when we take the natural language approach, leveraging the artificial intelligence side and be able to capture intent and open-ended questions and understand, and very quickly the caller realizes, oh, this thing understands me. This thing's going to help me. It gives it a chance. And, that's a big piece of the puzzle is we're not trying to make it, it's human-like. It's a human-like interaction because we're using natural language, because you can speak naturally as opposed to have to articulate differently because it's a bot. But the idea is that you build that trust. And that's the human aspect, is creating that connection with the caller that says, I'm going to help you.
You make me not want to hit 0.
Well, it's funny because, I have 2 pet peeves ever since I joined the company, and I had them before I joined the company, but I don't like calling someplace, getting a machine, going through information like who I am and my account number and authenticating, and then they have to send me to a person, and that person asks all the same questions.
Right, exactly. That happens a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, it drives me insane. So that's part of how we approach it with our customers is, hey, we need to be able to pass you what we've already done so when your call center picks up, all that work's already done. You don't have to redo that work, and your caller has a better experience. It's all about that caller experience. And then my other pet peeve is when someone says operator or representative, how many times, out there listening, how many times have you called in and you've said that, and the next question is, well, what is it you want to talk to somebody about? I still might be able to help you.
Right.
I have a question about my bill. Oh, you want to pay your bill? No, I have a question about my bill. Oh, you have a question about billing? Yes. Okay, well, which bill are you because the bot's trying to trap you. It wants to keep you in that machine.
Right, you get stuck in the cycle.
Right, and it's frustrating, right? And that's counterintuitive to customer service. You don't want to create customer frustration. Right. You're trying to create customer service. So we take the approach, someone wants out, they're out. Send them over. Now, there's on occasion where we say, there are longer wait times. Do you want to call back or do you want to wait? But we don't try and trap them in the bot. Again, we're the best customer service for someone who doesn't want to talk to a machine is to get them out of the machine.
Right.
So
in working and I guess in the sales process, how do you overcome the obstacle of customers wanting human interaction in the business? What's the conversation like, and how does that relate to your product?
So we come across that quite a bit. Of course, everybody wants to have people talk to people. Right. And that's, at the end of the day, your hope and expectation is that's the best customer service. The problem you run into is you don't always have the availability or the budget or whatever it may be to have all the people you need. And you start to run into challenges where you have long hold times and long wait times. And though eventually talking to a person is what someone wants, the longer it takes them to get to a person or the harder it is for them to get a hold of somebody, the more frustrated they get. And you actually deteriorate that customer experience while actually trying to hold to, we always let somebody talk to a person. In today's environment, which was happening before pre-pandemic, we already started to see workforce challenges, but it's so much exacerbated now with, pull whatever phrase you want, the great resignation, the great departure, the incredible shrinking workforce, whatever you want to call it. The service industry is decimated by that. And those call centers are service jobs. And to keep people, you're having to pay a lot more and you find people, you say things like, well, we'll pay more, we'll find people. You still can't find people even though you're offering more.
Right. That's not quite how it works.
Right. So your capacity is nowhere near what it used to be, but your demand is probably 100, 110, 120% of what it was. So what that does is it creates hold times. You want to maintain that human interaction. We have people we talk to who have 3-hour hold times. And how many of those calls that are on hold could be handled because they're a simple question, or I want to change an appointment, or they, you know, they got a bill and they want to pay their bill. Like, these are things that can be automated. And what happens is, if you start to automate these calls, you actually, we've found with customers when we've done the analysis with them, their CSAT scores go up, their net promoter scores go up, because their customers get the help they need without having to wait. And when something's more complex, because you've offloaded so many of these repeatable calls to the bot, you actually have bandwidth in that call center now. You actually have people, the wait time might only be 15, 20 minutes, 5 minutes, or they answer right away. But now the people who are really having an issue that the machine can't solve, because those exist, they actually get somebody, and they get somebody in a timely fashion and get the help they need. So the reality is that in today's world, I want to maintain a human touch with my customers. You're actually deteriorating that human experience without having automation in place.
True. Do you have a way, how do you go about measuring success for clients who buy your product, like an ROI? Yeah. Are you able to establish that for a client?
Certainly. So that ROI is the biggest piece of it. Obviously dealing with the machine costs less than dealing with a person. There's calculations we can do. How many calls do we expect? We run through a whole process. We do a call study and understand their volume and the call types and things like that. And then we'll put an ROI together. And we're usually very conservative about that ROI. But we find that in almost all of our clients, that ROI is impressive, or it is compelling, the ROI. And, you know, there are some customers where that ROI isn't maybe as incredible, but the intangible cost that's happening to them comes into play. So, you know, there's an ROI, or the machine pays for itself, but savings-wise, you know, you're not losing customers, or you're not turning people away, or you're not having these other frustrations. And there's a huge value to that as well.
Customer retention.
So the customer retention, you know, some of our customers, like I said, they do polling, and they get their customer satisfaction and net promoter scores, and we participate in that with them, or, you know, look for those numbers from them. But predominantly, it's an ROI-based equation. You know, it pays for itself. It puts money to the bottom line. That money can go to retaining your positive staff, other marketing. You know, we've even, you know, some of the people we've talked to recently who are actually running BPOs, with, you know, these large call centers for multiple customers. We usually work with the customer.
Can you explain BPO just for our
audience? Business process outsourcing. So it's a call center that handles, let's say, you know, multiple customers. So whereas we sit in front of that on the customer basis, so, you know, we would set up a bot for one of our customers. The calls would come to us first. We can't help them, we would then send it to that call center, that third-party call center. Well, there's conversations with those third-party call centers that say, hey, you know, you're having the same capacity problem. How are you going to have growth this year, next year, and the year after? The only way you're going to get growth is to create capacity. Well, how do you create capacity? Let us start putting digital, we call them IVA, intelligent virtual agents, because they're not operators. They're not receptionists. They're actually agents. They can actually complete tasks and do things. How do we put them in front of the BPO? Take those minutes away from the call center. That then makes more minutes you can go sell to somebody else. So basically every minute you defer to the bot is a minute of potential growth you could have by selling to another customer. When you say what's the impetus, what's the measure of success? You know, the measure of success is happy customers for us, happy customers for our customers, and, you know, a financial impact. We don't take the ROI and say, okay, well, you can lay off 35 people from your, you know, that's really, you know, not the approach we try and take. It's more along the lines of, you won't have to add more people, and you're going to solve these problems you're having. Because at the end of the day, I can sit down in front of a customer and say, hey, we can in your industry, we do these 15 things. Most often, 3 to 5 of them are pain points across everybody in that particular industry. So they'll right away say, well, that's a problem, that's a problem, that's a problem. Okay, great, I can solve those problems. And then as we solve those problems and have success, all right, Let's add something else, and expand those pieces. Especially back to your human-like conversation, there are customers who are concerned about having a bot or a machine in play. Right. So you start small, right? Get your customers used to it. See that it works. See that your customers aren't rejecting the notion of having a machine help them, and then you can start to expand that footprint in a strategic way to continue to grow that ROI.
Right. Do you do multiple languages for organizations?
We do. We've done predominantly English and Spanish, but we have the capability of doing most any language.
Being a company that it really works in the AI space, tell us about Smart Action and how do you adopt the concept of innovation? So you're obviously a high-tech company doing really challenging things every single day trying to improve, but What does innovation look like for you?
Innovation for us has pivoted a couple times recent past. There's a period of time where everything was our own tech stack, so we were having to, expand our own speech rec, expand our own TTS, expand our own the AI capabilities within certain functions and parts of the system. And then as, other companies out there that have all the money and all the resources, like Google, Microsoft, Amazon, commoditize certain pieces of that equation, like speech recognition, right? It's, you call an API, you send it audio, you get back text. As I started to look at what we were doing, to continue to try and compete with that, we would outdo them speech rec-wise for a long period of time until suddenly we weren't, mm-hmm. right? We were, now they're as good as us. Okay, now they're better, whatever. So we made the pivot to say, okay, we'll start using some of these third-party tools. The benefit there is I can then focus more innovation into what happens between the speech rec and the text-to-speech, algorithmic and artificial intelligence, how we make those decisions, building out better components that use better natural language models that understand things better than the competitors can provide, and really focusing on that piece of the puzzle of the understanding and the variations and the functions that we can provide to our customers, and let the commodities on the bookends be the commodities. And what that does is it provides not only a better experience for our customers and their customers, also enables them, my clients, to have sort of kind of front edge of some of these technology pieces that don't require me to make massive investments, because I'm investing in the way better sweet spot in the middle and making that so awesome. As speech rec gets better, as the text-to-speech engines sound more human-like, they'll get those advances because we're just plugged into that now, as opposed to having to have me continue to invest, our version of those stay competitive. I can now focus on the in-between and get better intelligence, better customer understanding, continue to refine the back and forth to get that more empathetic, or on a sales side, that more push, if you will, to really achieve the customer's business goals and customer service goals, and not have to invest in commoditized endpoints.
So with all this innovation and mm-hmm. technology, what kind of staff do you hire? Who's helping you with this to move the needle forward, with your strategic direction?
You're kind of both sides, because not only are we building the bots, we also then manage them as a service. I've got the engineers. We're usually looking for early stage career, kind of hungry, learn a lot. They're helping innovate and build those things. I have a couple of product managers and a manager with in that road that help provide, here's what we want to do next, and the roadmap and so forth. But you get those kind of young, up-and-coming, hungry engineers who want to go do something cool and then want to leverage that to whatever their next thing is. That's that sweet spot there. And then on the other side, we're looking at like technical account managers, support, things of that nature, where, they're really the eyes and the ears for the business. They're providing, we have a customer portal that provides certain data points and things like that, but they're going next level. Hey, I dug into this, or this, and we think we can make this change, or here, or I made this change, and we've seen a 3, 5, 10, 20% pickup in completion or understanding or whatever it may be. We're managing that downstream. So I've got kind of a functional group of post-delivery managing the natural language processing and the different pieces of the equation.
The data
analysis. It needs to pet care and feeding, and this is a big piece of the puzzle that a lot of customers and a lot of people in the market, because voice recognition and so forth is so ubiquitous. Everybody talks to Siri. They've got Googles or Alexas in their house. They think it's easy. What happens next when that text comes back? That's hard. That's not easy. And that takes a lot of work. And if you're going to work in an island just unto yourself, it's very difficult. And to have people who understand the NLU and understand, deal with the algorithms and manage intents and all the different pieces that happen between the bookends is complex. And the way we work is, you go hire a person, you find a unicorn that can do all that for you, you've already spent more money than my solution is going to cost you. So we're really in that point where the idea is that we're providing not only the technology, but then we're continuing to manage it for you. And because of the scale and us working across multiple verticals, as we find or fix challenges for one customer or improve something over here in a piece of the puzzle for this customer, it actually benefits you over here. And if you're working just with your own data sets and your own calls, as opposed to the millions and millions and millions of calls that I'm dealing with, you're only going to catch certain pieces, and you're only going to fix certain pieces. So what happens is you deploy and you've got a scale of diminishing returns, Whereas with us, you deploy, the idea is you actually should continue to grow and increase because we're constantly tuning, adjusting, and applying expertise against what's happening, not only to your individual bot, but also the components within it across industries to have a better understanding.
Great. Fascinating. So, Gary, I know you moved the company to Fort Worth in 2021. Is that correct?
That's correct.
From Los Angeles?
Yep.
Why Fort Worth? Why Tarrant County?
March 15th, LA shut down or sent everybody home. 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 2 months. And we hit a point where, you know, we were doing polling of our employees through surveys, and it really turned to, hey, you know, a lot of employees are like, I'm never going back to the office. We're a tech company. We made the transition to virtual very quickly. You know, I started looking in terms of the challenges around LA, the challenges around hiring people in LA. And once we made that, hey, we're going to be virtual decision, we opened up hiring to anywhere in the United States. And we really started to find that for, you know, our pay scale, we could get actually high, you know, high quality people mm-hmm. in through, you know, through certain areas of the country that we certainly can't compete in LA. So looking at that, I said, well, in addition, we probably, you know, let's move headquarters. If we're virtual and we can be anywhere, let's get out of California because it's challenging to do business in California. Probably read that a million times by
yes.
now.
So a few times.
So I started looking at other places. Now, I've always had a personal affinity for Texas and DFW in particular. And so I did kind of blind outreach to a handful of places. So I, you know, I did Dallas, did Fort Worth, Nashville, Vegas, two cities in Florida, and Atlanta. And, you know, had a, hey, this is who I am. This is, I have this tech company. We've gone virtual. I'm looking for, you know, to relook at the headquarters. Do you have certain incentives? Is, you know, just kind of an opportunity to creatively fundraise, if you will, as well as, you know, change the paradigm of who we are as an organization. Mm-hmm. Frankly, Fort Worth was like Johnny on the spot. They came back immediately. They engaged right away. One or two of the other cities kind of had feedback. It just wasn't as energetic, wasn't as committed, if you will, as mm-hmm. Fort Worth was. So, you know, started looking at Fort Worth, made a few trips out here. One employee was already out in the area, had been here in the past for other things. So it really started to ring true. And as I worked with the city, you know, it was really interesting to see where they started with the incentive program and then working with them as a tech company, like, hey, we're not building a building. This doesn't look, what you're sending me is if I'm doing construction, but I'm tech. So we got to, you got to rethink how you're going to measure these things and what these commitments look like or how this works. And they were wonderfully collaborative on that and had some really great ideas on how to do that. So it worked out really well. And it just sort of landed on, this was what makes sense. It makes sense for the organization. It makes sense for, you know, me as the CEO. Pulled the trigger, made the move, and we've not been, you know, couldn't be happier. It's interesting the opportunities that have come to us because of the move to Texas that weren't there for us when we were in California.
You're finding more business here?
We're finding here? Certainly more business here. We're finding that even partners that were here that we were connected with while in LA, it's a completely different tenor and tone and collaboration now that we're here versus being from LA. Mm-hmm. Regionally, it's a big pickup for us or a big motivation for us. But then also, as we go talk to other people in the country, it's, you know, there's a piece there where it's like, you left California. And there's just this sort of implied understanding that you as an organization are making the moves to make sure you're the best you can be for us. And moving from California to Texas, Fort Worth in particular, but you know, making that move, you know, shows that you're looking to continue to be on the front edge of things. You're looking to innovate. So many tech companies are moving, you know, to the Lone Star State that, and I looked at Austin, and my problem with Austin was it was very impacted, right? So you have these challenges where resources every 18 months they go find new jobs and the cost of everything goes up. And Fort Worth was, hey, we want to be the next tech hub. We want to bring you, and then we want to bring others, and then we want to keep bringing others. And, you know, there's challenges with all of that. And I talked to the city, I talked to the chamber, like kind of my perspective, but that's the goal. That's what they're after is, you know, they, you know, 10 years, 15 years from now, they want to be where Nashville was, you know, five years ago, if you will.
Right.
Certainly want to be part of that. You know, I'm a small company, but you know, you got to start somewhere. Right. You need that first drop in the bucket. Right.
That's right. Exactly. So, that's what I always tell people. You know, you got to start somewhere.
Right. So it's, you know, it just was, you know, I don't see, you know, kismet maybe, but it worked out really well. Again, it was very easy to land on that decision based on the interaction I was having with the people at the city and the people at the chamber and then people such as yourself. And, you know, just kind of once I got here, just I've never run into a standoffish anything. Everybody's been very welcoming. Organizations are eager to help. Everybody's up for a conversation. So it's just it's been a really great opportunity. And everyone introduces you to others. Like the networking aspect of making this move, again, nothing like we were able to get in Los Angeles. So it's made a big impact for us. And I didn't make anyone pick up a move, offered an incentive for them to do so. Some did. And then as we've had turnover, we've just been rehiring, you know, focusing our rehiring on the DFW area and have had good success with that.
Oh, I'm curious to know with the hiring, most of your employees are virtual.
Right.
Opening up kind of the hiring process, if you will, if it is a virtual position, have you found better options in finding talent? Because
yes.
One of the things that you hear, obviously, in the tech industry is, you know, trying to find people with the right skill sets. And
right.
I'm just curious, did that help opening up that world of virtual
yeah.
work from home?
The work from home also has challenges. You know, not to get too, you know, too pandemically lost in the politics of things, but when we first went virtual, we had a huge uptick in productivity. And it was because there was nothing else to do. I mean, even myself, I'd get up at, you know, 10 o'clock at night to go grab a cup of water, and at 2 a.m. I realize I'm still sitting at my computer working, right? Just because it was right there.
Right. It's so, there. You can't leave the living room.
Right. Right. The office and home, there, you know, you talk about having a balance. Well, there's no balance. It's the same thing all the time.
Right.
Well, at some point, that starts to wear on people. So we've done a lot of work around the corporate culture and things to deal with, you know, try and, you know, provide. We do virtual happy hours. We try and take go meet with other coworkers, or we set up a Regis, go have a team meeting, like trying to get people to collaborate or get together. But the virtual side, there is still a desire clearly with employees that, yeah, I can work from home, but does anybody live near me? Where's everybody else? Where's the office? Like, they still want on occasion the availability to go and collaborate and have community,
some kind of social connection.
Yeah,
correct?
So you know, we recently I actually have a meeting tomorrow, a construction meeting tomorrow morning. We're taking a space downtown at the Fort Worth Club building, so our office will be downtown Fort Worth, which I think is important given the move to Fort Worth. But it's also central, and as we look for the early stage career folks, the, you know, you've got things like public transport and, you know, different pieces of the puzzle that make sense by being downtown. It's not the huge space where the entire company comes to work every day. It's not small, but it's a smaller space that, you know, we may have a handful of people in and out each day, or, you know, people once or twice a week, who knows. I'll go in a couple times a week to have that office environment or quiet space, whatever it may be, right. But it's changed. It still has that draw to it, if you will. Right. I had an employee in Colorado. I got one in Pennsylvania. Like, we've got people elsewhere, but I'm trying to make sure that there's still a sense of community and we have the ability to gather at times if we can.
It's important to the culture.
It is. And it's important to the mental well-being of your employees, myself included. I can't tell you how many times I've been on a Zoom and my dog stopped barking. It's like at some point I...
We've all had that, haven't we, over the past couple of years, for sure.
That's rough.
So, Gary, with being such a tech-related company and everything, obviously my expertise is the learning and development space. Mm-hmm. What does learning and development look like for the employees of Smart Action?
We have a lot to do. We're busy. And it's hard to balance... Let's get stuff done and let's deliver for clients and let's innovate, let's change the way we do things, which is what we've been doing. And also along the way, let's set time aside for, you know, personal growth or education. And it's hard. We provide certain tool sets to our employees to do those sorts of things. We try to make time available for them. We have an education stipend. If someone wants to, if PM wants to go get certified, we can help offset that cost. If, you know, an engineer wants to take a certain course, we can help offset that cost. But, you know, a lot of that is more monetary and, hey, on your own time type stuff,
right.
Which is, again, what I, you know, go back to the other conversation, someone's own time is a lot grayer than it used to be. And we try. We had a hackathon last year. You know, we had our first hackathon. We had four different problems we were trying to solve. We threw them to four different engineering teams. And, you know, they had to go research and learn and figure out how, okay, what tools can I bring to solve this beyond the ones I currently have? Because obviously if our current tools would solve it, we'd already have solved these problems.
Right, exactly.
So
hence the innovation.
Right. Had to acquire them to innovate, acquire them to learn and, you know, a certain level of education and thought. And then, you know, and then you start to push the envelope. You know, I'm going to, hey, all right, engineering group, you're going to present your hack to the whole company in an all hands meeting, right? So it's also, you know, kind of, it's the other side of the equation. There's the, hey, go in the cave and solve a problem. But then there's the other side of come out in the light and share it with everybody. Professional development, you know, soft skills management, but then there's also the, you know, kind of the hard and fast. And for a long time as an organization, the way we did things and the foundational tech we were using didn't lend itself for that kind of go, you know, new tools and what's out in the marketplace and how do you bring X, Y, and Z to bear, or can you get a piece of software that then you do X, Y, and Z to, and it now explodes for us in terms of some far better way of doing it. We really weren't able to do that. Now in the last year and a half, as we've pivoted away from some of that legacy locked in tech and started to use certain third party pieces, it's so much more capable for our team to learn new things and go do new things. And frankly, things that they can then carry with them. And I think it's a big piece of when your target audience or your target employees are early stage or early career people, you have to have part of your element be when their time with us has ended, they have a quantifiable lift in their skills to take elsewhere.
Right. A trajectory forward for
their
career path.
And it's been a very big challenge for us because really there was a very consulting aspect where, you know, engineers and PMs just grind them and then they're commodities, just grind them. And we've worked very hard to transition away from that and get to where no. The project managers and engineers are delivering, right? They're delivery. They're everything we talk about and everything we're doing doesn't work if they're not making those changes and pushing the envelope and moving us forward, right? So they're not commodities; they're valuable, and the value that the value they should get from us is that level of growth. And the value we get from them is the work product they provide. And it's been we still struggle with it sometimes. There are times when it's like just I don't care, just get stuff done. But you know, it's definitely far better than it used to be.
So, Gary, I'm curious, as a CEO, what challenges are you finding as a leader of a high-tech company, and what are you doing for your own professional development?
They say things like it's, you know, being a CEO is the loneliest job type thing. So it is tough to kind of sit with, hey, the decisions lie with me. If it doesn't get figured out before it gets to me, I own those decisions. Mm-hmm. Really keeping the organization focused, keeping us moving in the right direction, and making sure that, you know, we've got other leaders in the organization that are going to drive our continued success and change and work to, you know, when I talk about growth, well, there's growth within that leadership team. My job is to provide value for my shareholders, okay? Well, the way I'm going to provide value for my shareholders is I'm going to have dynamic leaders that grow under my stewardship and drive their part of the organization to grow under their stewardship, and we're all going to do cool things and deliver for customers and grow the business to where I provide value for my investors, right? For my shareholders. How I do is I think of myself as a lifetime learner. Now, my mom would tell you in my teenage years that wasn't true.
Should we have mom on the call today?
Yeah, right, exactly. I try and read a lot. You know, I don't have the time I used to sit and read books. I'll do a lot of articles. I will read, you know, a lot of nonfiction. So when I read, it's nonfiction stuff. I try and balance a couple of more heady things with, like, you know, a pop band story or something. But, you know, just to cleanse the palate. I've got a couple of friends at this point, but I brought in an executive coach for my entire team. So not just a CEO coach, but a team one coach, if you will. Mm-hmm. So we've had that coach in place for about a year, which has had a really good impact on us. I have someone who used to be a CEO, who's a trusted confidant. So, you know, him and I will talk certain things and he'll kind of help. He never tells me what to do, but he helps me find my way to answer those questions myself.
Help you navigate the waters.
Exactly, yes. I meet with a couple of board members on a periodic basis. There's the, hey, here's a board meeting, we're board members, and then there's, hey, here's this meeting, we're here to help you continue to find success. So that works really well too. So that, you know, I've got a pretty decent net of support for myself. And then the things that I learn or the process I go through or when I pick up that's a really good way of doing that, I'm bringing that back to my team to help them grow and help them improve in what they're doing. You know, at some point, you know, there's one or two people on my team that are going to be CEOs someday.
So help to grow them.
That's right.
So yeah. Are there any CEOs out there? Obviously, you mentioned one in particular. CEOs that you look up to?
Bob Iger, Elon Musk, the Jeff Bezos, all those guys out there that are just, you know, but everyone's looking. They're celebrities at this point. But at the end of the day, they've done incredible things. And They've led these massive organizations and, you know, in some cases like Bezos and Musk created organizations out of nothing into these huge companies. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, you listen to their stories and you're like, wow, my little company and the things I'm dealing with, I actually can relate to that. And I can relate to that. I had a really good Vistage group in LA, some really good CEOs in that group. They're very collaborative. I've joined a new group here. My first meeting will be this next month with them. So,
and for those that don't know that are listening, sure. So Vistage International is a CEO executive leadership organization. I was a member many years ago when I was in corporate America. It's a great organization, just so for clarity for our audience.
Right. So, again, it's a the idea is I have some place to go that I have peers who aren't competitors and aren't my board or aren't like they're judgment free and we're there to help each other and collaborate. And
it's a great
while we're all
group.
In different industries, they've seen things, I've seen things, and sometimes, hey, wait, I saw that. Wait, I saw that. Oh, wait. Oh, we should do that, right? And that advice and that insight and process an issue and they'll walk you through and everyone has input and ask a bunch of questions. It really makes you navigate through those waters and think differently. So I've had some really good interactions with some folks there. And, I've got a personal friend who was a CEO for a period and he's been very helpful as well. And my coach has been helpful. But, a couple of folks on the board have been CEOs. So one of my independent board members was a CEO in our space. So he's got a different outlook. And, you know, I come from a tech and operations background, and this board member comes from a sales enablement background. So it's great to have someone who, hey, that expertise is on the side of the fence that I'm not as strong on. Now, you know, I've had to learn quick, but, my history is, you know, my background is around the supply chain or the digital delivery and, you know, the SDLC, you know, software development lifecycle, all those pieces of that puzzle. His is, hey, we're out front and we're closing deals. It's been a big help in that aspect too, to have, you know, have that independent board member who's had that experience who, you know, it doesn't matter what I want to talk about. He eventually comes back to what's going on with this and the sales side.
Right.
So it really keeps me honest.
It's great to have those kind of people around you. Kind of makes the puzzle complete, if you will. Well, Gary, we really appreciate having you on today. So I'm going to ask just one last question.
Sure.
So obviously TCC is a community college. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of folks from community colleges in the listening audience. What advice would you have for any young student person coming out of a tech program at the college pertaining to, you know, now the now and future of the workforce, if you will?
You know, first of all, I think it's, you know, you come out of a program from, for example, TCC in a particular discipline, leverage that. Don't discount what you've accomplished. I went to a community college.
I did
out
too.
Of high school, yeah. So I started at a community college and then, you know, went through a program, transferred to the UC I wanted to go to. But you're learning that when you open to page whatever in a book or you do whatever engineering exercise, you write some piece of, you know, Python script or some piece of C# code and you compile it and it works. Well, that same code works the same way as Harvard as it does at TCC.
True story.
Right? So you've learned it. You know how to do it. And don't diminish that in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, carry that with you and go into the market or as you interview with people, have that confidence of, no, yeah, I know what I'm doing. I've done this. Realize too that you're right now, if you're taking a class, a certain set of classes at TCC, for example, in a certain discipline, you're probably at the cutting edge of where education's going.
Absolutely.
Spending $150,000 on a 4-year education is becoming not necessarily the way the world's going to work anymore. And having particular expertise in a particular discipline that will help you get a job, expand, and then that job will expand that knowledge and work in that job and compete against others. That's where that's headed. And the ability to make those shifts quickly. You look at 80% of the jobs 20 years from now don't even exist yet.
That is true.
Right. So 20 years from now, if you're 20 years old, you're in college to get a degree to do whatever, 80% of the jobs when you're 40, you're not prepared for from college because
it's changing.
Those jobs
so
don't
fast.
Exist yet. Right.
Exactly.
So, the ability to say, well, okay, I'm going to go take a set of courses that's going to teach me a discernible skill. And then I'm going to go work that skill to make a living and make my way and improve my situation or whatever it is. Yes, go do that. And I think that's a huge benefit, especially in the community college network. And then what you and the team do here at TCC is rapidly adjusting to that reality, in my opinion. And it's a big deal. It's a big piece of that puzzle. And I think that you're out there listening and you're in a program at TCC and you've got a I complete this program, I'll have this skill. Yeah, you're actually making the right decision and doing the right thing, and go do it. And don't for a minute think, well, it's a community college. So what? Like I said, the books are the same, the code's the same, it all works the same. There's some very smart people I know didn't necessarily have, it's not like they had some crazy, they're not smart because of some diploma that hangs on their wall. They're smart because they're smart. So go do it. Hold your head high, wear the badge, and do it.
So. There you go. Well, I could not think of a better way to end this episode. Okay. So, Gary, thank you so much for being here today.
Well,
we really
me.
Appreciate it. We look forward to having you on perhaps a future episode.
Sure.
And see where you are in a few years from now. That would be wonderful. Well, thank you all to the listening audience, and we look forward to seeing you on the next edition of the Workforce Lens.